This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, September 5th, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. The Trump administration is reportedly moving ahead with plans to change rules governing overtime pay, raising the question, why does the federal government regulate overtime pay? In any case, Cato's Ryan Bourne argues the perceived benefits to workers will likely be short-term, if they arrive at all. The Trump administration has plans to raise the overtime pay salary threshold up to $36,000. Now, for people who don't work jobs that offer overtime, what does that actually mean?
Well, yeah, this was a report in the Wall Street Journal last week. Now, at the moment, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, anyone below a certain income threshold is eligible by law if they work more than 40 hours per week to be paid at least 1.5 times their regular wage for any of those hours above 40 hours per week. So in essence, what this change to the regulation would mean is that raising that salary threshold would mean that more people would become eligible and fall under this banner of this overtime pay. So I think the estimates have suggested that about 1.3 million extra people would fall under this regulation if this change were made. Now, this is something that has been discussed in the past. President Obama's administration wanted to raise this threshold even more significantly, I believe, to over $50,000. And usually this is sold as a good news story by administrations proposing it. They say that not only will the employees themselves see a boost to their total compensation, but some people even suggest that as a result of this, firms might be likely to create more jobs or at least distribute hours more evenly, such that more people can benefit from more hours. Now, those two things are directly contradictory, but they seem to believe that mandating this overtime pay across a broader range of people will bring some economic benefits.
Okay, so what that effectively means is that the range of jobs for which overtime must be paid, to the extent somebody's working more than 40 hours a week, that range of jobs is now would be larger.
Yeah, because you're widening the salary range, which would fall under this. And, you know, this would cover a wide range of different jobs, as a result.
So, the logical question, why is the federal government involved in setting rules governing pay rates and, at what point in your work week you begin earning 1.5 times pay?
Well, traditionally, governments have got involved in this type of activity in terms of wage setting because there's a belief that employers kind of have a degree of market power, have a whip hand over their employees, and that without the benign interventions of governments, people will be exploited and made to work significantly more hours than government bureaucrats determine is kind of optimal from a social perspective and from the perspective of those individual employees. But of course, that doesn't really speak to kind of the economic case for why this is being made. And there's a hell of a lot of both theory and evidence out there that suggests that actually in the longer term, when you mandate benefits in this way or mandate that people have to be paid for certain activities, what actually happens in the longer term is that firms adjust base pay accordingly to keep total compensation the same. So in this case, if you're making firms pay more in the way of overtime pay, what firms will do is adjust hours or base wage rates such that overall this won't cost them in net terms. And that appears to be what happens when you actually look at the evidence from previous changes to this threshold.
So if you're a politician and one who did well in states where people tend to have lower incomes like Donald Trump, this looks like a win for those workers. And you're saying probably not really.
Well, in the short run, employers have business practices and contracts with their employees that obviously take time to change. So I don't think anybody should pretend that some workers wouldn't benefit from higher total compensation in the immediate aftermath of the rule change, as employers become legally obliged to pay that extra overtime. And that will no doubt be the outcome that if the Trump administration do this, that they trump it. But the key point here is that as time goes by, employers adjust. Now, that might initially come through managing their workforce to minimize the likelihood of paying those overtime rates, you know, changing shift patterns, recategorizing workers into exempt categories, perhaps even outsourcing certain tasks to firms such that, you know, you don't fall under the purview directly in an employer sense. But basic economics, as I say, tells us that what employers ultimately care about the total costs of employment. So in time, I believe the overwhelming response of this type of regulation will be employers cutting those base pay rates such that if they know that they're going to have to pay overtime, total costs of employment, total compensation remains essentially unchanged. And as I say, there's, you know, this isn't just a theory. This has been something that numerous empirical studies have looked at. And what they tend to find is that actually these types of decisions don't have a discernible impact on overtime hours, but what they do is lead to a reduction in those hourly wages to neutralize the effect of the overtime regulation. So in essence, what we're seeing here is the federal government trying to mandate a particular benefit. And as a consequence, firms reacting by reducing base pay and making that trade-off for their employees quite explicit. And this is something that we see across a range of different other potential mandated benefits or attempts to regulate pay.
To the extent that the Trump administration is getting involved, in a sense, by sort of changing rules governing overtime pay, that's really relatively small potatoes compared to what some Democrats have proposed. Kamala Harris wants to set an equal pay rule that would incur fines if larger companies are found to be paying women less than men or some groups less than others.
Yeah, that's right. And essentially what these types of regulations or, you know, fines, interventions do is they make employers determine the types of contracts that they have with their employees to a much greater extent because there's a monetary cost to deviating. So at the moment, you tend to find lots of instances where, you know, employees may well accept lower base pay such that they're able to benefit from, say, more flexible working hours or an ability to work from home or other kind of compensating benefits that may result from that trade between employers and employees. But what these types of regulations do is really kind of force or shoehorn employers into setting contracts in quite a homogenous way. And, you know, that may well benefit some employees, but it comes at a big cost to others who benefit from more flexible working arrangements, or in this case, in the overtime pay regulation sense, would actually prefer base pay to be higher. If all employees under a particular employer are now governed by this type of contract such that base pay is lower, then those who don't undertake overtime pay, of course, would suffer on net as a result of this if employers went down that route of cutting base pay in compensation for the greater amounts they've got to now pay in overtime pay. So there's trade-offs in labor market contracts in a free market, and employees and employers come to trades. You know, not everybody likes their work contract, but there is a high degree of flexibility. And the more that you mandate particular benefits or you mandate different forms of contract and try to get involved, the more employers are likely to react in a way that they try and kind of mitigate those costs by homogenizing contracts. And that really does eliminate lots of the flexibilities that some people benefit from.
So what do you say to people who say, Ryan, what you're saying is all well and good, but we have seen corporate profits at their highest levels in many, many years. returns to capital are very high, returns to labor are very low, and that should indicate generally that workers have a poorer negotiating position when it comes to the labor market today.
Well, that's an incredibly big macroeconomic question, which we could have numerous different podcasts to speak about. But one thing that I would say is that actually, if you look at the overall health of the labor market, the best way for workers to benefit from a better bargaining position is to have a tight labor market where wages are rising and job opportunities are plentiful. And at the moment, obviously, there's some potential economic difficulties on the horizon, but unemployment rates are incredibly low. Employment rates adjusted for the demographics of the population appear to be back roughly where they were prior to the crash. And as a result of that tighter labor market, it does appear that wage growth has been ticking up somewhat in the last couple of years. Now, if that is to continue, one would hope that would provide workers with more opportunities. And that, you know, with that comes an opportunity to better match workers' demands with employers' demands. So I'm a bit surprised when you look at the health of the labor market in the US and other relatively free market labor market regulatory countries, and compare that to the performance of some of the very heavily regulated labor markets in continental Europe, where you have lots of these mandated benefits, it does really surprise me that people look at those two very, very different unemployment rates and say, actually, it would be much better for workers if we moved in the direction of more government intervention as seen in Europe. There does appear to be a trade-off here. And I think the best thing for workers in the longer term is to have those freedoms to negotiate contracts and to try to keep macroeconomic policy such that labor markets are tight, and as a result, job opportunities and wage rate growth is pretty healthy.
Ryan Bourne occupies the R. Evan Scharf Chair for the Public Understanding of Economics at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.